Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
It was only a matter of time before we turned our attention to low-volume British sports car manufacturers because there's just so much to discuss. Andrew, but before we get onto that, there are a couple of quite big topical news stories that we want to cover off first. So tell me what you think of that pretty remarkable looking Bugatti Bolide.
I'm going to be a bit Scrooge-like over this. What's it for? I mean, it seems to me that what they have done is create a car which doesn't have to subscribe to any rules at all, which is a tiny bit quicker, in theory at least, around Le Mans than one which has to subscribe to a rule book 3 feet thick. What I suspect it's for, and I may be completely wrong on this, I don't have any inside track in this at all, I suspect they will make some and they'll have, like, you know, the Ferrari FXX program, and they'll wheel them out for their punters specified track days, and people can get to see what doing 0 to 250 miles an hour in 12 seconds feels like. Pretty uncomfortable, I would think. But, I suppose if I say that, people might say, aha, yes, but you went mad over the 919 Evo, which is another car which doesn't have to subscribe to any laws, but at least that was derived from a car that did, to the extent that it still had a 2-litre four-cylinder engine in it, not an 8-litre 16-cylinder engine in it. And so to me, that is, you know, that is a bit more legitimate. And also, you know, it comes from a company whose recent track record in driving things fast around tracks is unimpeachable, whereas, you know, Bugatti as a company has not raced successfully. It has raced, but not successfully since before the war. So I don't know what it is and I don't know what it's for. What about you?
Yeah, it's interesting. What is it for? They've said that at the moment it's a fully functional concept car. So it apparently does run. But yeah, those lap times, they're modeled, aren't they? They're in theory.
They are. It has run. You know, there's footage of it. Well, there's not much. There's a few seconds of it going around Paul Ricard. So it definitely does work.
Yeah, perhaps if they ever get around to actually doing those lap records, we'll be able to take it a bit more seriously. Just to give you some numbers, the lap record at Le Mans is held by Kamui Kobayashi in the Toyota Hybrid. In qualifying in 2017, he did a 3:14, 3:14. And Bugatti has plugged a load of data into a computer, presumably, and it spat out a number that says that it's 8 seconds faster, the Bolide, 8 seconds faster than that Kobayashi lap time, which is, you know, what does that even mean?
Imagine you went to Toyota and said, okay, take your whatever it is, TS050, your LMP1 hybrid, and we're going to throw away the rules And yeah, do to that car what Porsche did to the 919. I mean, they wouldn't find 8 seconds. They'd find 20, 30. I mean, they would find armfuls of time out of it. So I don't see what point Bugatti is trying to prove beyond, I guess, it being a publicity. And I may be being terribly unfair and unkind here. But do you not think we're just getting to the stage now? And I'm sure we'll talk about the, how do you pronounce it, Tuatara?
Yeah, we'll come to it, yeah.
Yeah, and the, you know, the Chiron that they did last year, you know, these 300 mile an hour cars. I just...
It's strange,
just,
isn't it?
It just turns me off. I think I do know why. I think I know why, because, you know, having been lucky enough to drive at 200 a few times, it's just enough. I mean, all you're doing going beyond that is grabbing headlines. I don't think you're proving anything to anyone, because, you know... not even on a racetrack are you ever going to get to those sorts of speeds, because the straights aren't long enough. So unless you go and hire Air Alesian or a bit of Nevada desert, these are meaningless numbers. They have no relevance. So I find myself getting turned off by the whole thing, I'm afraid.
So what's the difference for you between the Bugatti Bolide and Aston Martin Valkyrie? Okay, so some pretty impressive engineering going on with both. Staggering amount of money should the Bolide ever be sold. It's inevitably going to cost multiple millions.
Yeah.
So why do you sort of foam at the mouth about one and have no interest in the other?
Because, I mean, how many reasons do you want? Firstly, you know, the Valkyrie is a road car. So it has an immediate relevance and resonance there. You know, obviously it has, you know, the mark of Adrian Newey on it. We believe it is going to be, you know, genuinely expand the envelope of road car, but it's going to do stuff that road cars have never done before. And that is somebody who, you know, I appreciate that what it can do is largely academic, because none of us will be able to afford us. You know, most of us will never get to drive one or even sit in one or probably even see one. But there is an interest and a relevance and a legitimacy to a car with that heritage, with that function, that... something like the Bolide, which has just been conjured up out of nowhere with no pretense to make it road legal, no attempt to make it subscribe to any sets of rules. It's just, it seems to be Bugatti just going, we're going to build a really fast car. And of course, if you want to do that and you don't have to, you know, homologate it, and you don't have to race it, then, you know, you could do it, because it's just a question of numbers and money. But something like the Valkyrie, which, you know, people have to be able to drive down a public road. You know, I have a little bit of insight into that project, and I know just how difficult it has been. And look at, you know, how late the Mercedes One, as we're now have to call it, the old Project One, is. You know, these are, you know, getting those cars, you know, just through homologation, just getting them, you know, legal for the road is such a process. But I bet that when they, you know, they come out, they will actually be, I mean, if not sort of, you know, usable in a conventional sense, they will certainly be cars that you can get in and drive on the road. And, you know, as I say, I think those sorts of cars to me are massively more impressive technical accomplishments than a bunch of people just sitting down and go, right, we're going to make something really fast.
Okay, right, I've got 2 points to make on the Bugatti. First one's a question. Do you, and I don't mean to put you on the spot here.
Do you
know what Bolide means in French?
La 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 la. Do I know what Bolide, okay, thank you for this. The short answer to your question is no, I don't, but I did. Isn't a Bolide they used to call sort of 50s racing cars Bolides. Are they not just sort of lightweight, open, very sporty things?
It's literally racing car.
Oh, okay. Is that literally is it? Okay.
That's literally it, yeah, racing car in French. And I just, you know, maybe I'm being a bit hopeful, but perhaps that's a clue, you know? If there is some intention to actually go racing with this or something like it, then all of a sudden this whole Bolide project has credibility.
But would you race it? In what formula would you race it?
Le Mans hypercars.
Well, then you have to make road. You know, then they have to make 25 road cars in the first year and 100 in the second year.
And might that be on their minds? I'd be surprised if it is. However, all I'm saying is, if they went racing with it at Le Mans and built however they need to for homologation purposes,
yeah,
then I think it's a great project. You know, it all of a sudden it has a credibility and a purpose.
If they do that, and I don't think they will, but if they do that, I will come back on this podcast and apologise formally to them because I couldn't agree with you more. If they do that, and this is just a sort of backdoor into doing, you know, another road car which breaks down the boundaries again, then absolutely, I agree. That would be a very, very interesting, wildly more interesting proposition than this Bolide thing.
Okay. So the other thing I want to say is, I've dug out a few numbers. The Bolide's brake calipers weigh 2.4 kilograms apiece. The centre lock forged aluminium wheels weigh 7.4 kilograms at the front, 8.4 at the rear. I think the push rod is 100 grams. Point being, this is Bugatti talking about lightweight engineering.
Yeah.
And it hasn't done that with the Veyron and the Chiron.
Not at all.
And maybe, just maybe, this is the start of Bugatti really taking lightweighting seriously and deciding that actually a two-ton car perhaps isn't the right approach. And, you know, stripping some weight out of these things might make all the difference.
Oh, I do so hope so. I do. I absolutely hope so. But, you know, to be honest, if you're going to strip weight out of a Bugatti, the first thing, you know that engine, that 8-litre engine, it weighs 450 kilograms. You know, there are entire cars that weigh less than that. So if you're really going to get serious about lightweighting, the first thing you do is you get rid of that. But, you know, again, I know that I'm sounding, you know, particularly uncharitable about this and, you know, maybe you just caught me on a bad day. But, you know, if you are right, and this is, you know, a signal to the way they're going to go in the future, you know, all power to them. That makes me really, really happy. I've always said, you know, when the Veyron came out in whenever it was, 2005, I think, and it was a two-ton car with 1,000 horsepower. I can remember just saying at the time, if it was, instead of weighing 2,000 kilos and having 1,000 horsepower, it had weighed 1,500 kilos and had 750 horsepower. It would have had exactly the same power-to-weight ratio, but as a thing to drive, it would have been totally transformed. And, you know, if 15 years on, you know, they're starting to think that way too, great news.
We shall see. Right, it is fun, isn't it, when there's a controversy in our little corner of the world.
Oh, I know where we're going.
It's just quite amusing to watch it unfold, isn't it? Particularly when you don't have a vested interest and you just want to see the drama play out.
Yeah.
So I'm going to leave it to you to pronounce the car's name, the SSC.
SSC, there you go. You did it very nicely.
You cheat. Okay, Tuatara or something. Tuatara.
Tuatara. I've never heard it called that before, but maybe you're right.
Tuatara.
I'm either bloke who can't pronounce Murcielago or Murcielago, so who knows? That thing. Yes,
apparently,
the SSC.
Apparently the name is Maori, so yeah.
Okay.
It's not just a fabrication.
Okay.
So anyway, should we briefly give some background? So the SSC announced, or it claimed last week, wasn't it, that its car had broken the production car top speed record. And they released some footage of it driving very quickly along that road in Nevada, the same one that Koenigsegg used in 2017, I think it was. And the SSC hit a top speed of 331 miles per hour, and it did a two-way average of 316, apparently.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is, I mean, those are staggering numbers.
Staggering numbers.
Given that, you know, it wasn't that long ago that the Veyron climbing up to 250 after however many years after the McLaren F1 did 240, you know, that was an incremental step over 15 years or something, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And now we've got, so apparently, this American supercar hitting a top speed of 331. Although, it was pointed out by, I think really it was Shmi, wasn't it, who gave this controversy the momentum it's got. He released a video pointing out that there were inconsistencies in the footage.
Correct.
And it's rumbled along from there, hasn't it? So SSC then sort of punched back, saying actually the Austrian firm, a telemetry and timing firm, Devatron, had verified the speed. But then this firm came back and said, actually, we haven't.
We didn't
flames.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they're not verified. They weren't even there. And then SSC came out and admitted that the footage that they released was, and I quote, substantially inaccurate.
Yeah.
But they still stand by it, don't they? And I think they've now said that they have sent off the correct data file, which will prove to you, me, the timing people, and, you know, Guinness World Records, that what they did was as they said. And I don't know. I'm not going to cast any aspersions one way or the other, because I genuinely don't know. I think all I would say is that, you know, if you're going to do something like that, for goodness sake, you know, release the right clip or make sure you've got your ducks in a row first, because, you know, to get a car to do that, and, you know, I think driving road cars at over 300 miles an hour is one of the more pointless exercises, but nevertheless, it's impressive. And if you're going to go to all that effort to design a car that is that powerful and that slippery, yet sufficiently stable that, you know, a bloke can get in it and drive it at those sort of speeds, don't undermine the credibility of the whole thing by just, you know, messing up something as simple as that. Because, you know, I kind of think that people will always think from now on, you know, no smoke without fire. And, you know, it's going to be comparable. You know, and the sadness is, let's say that it was absolutely legitimate and just an honest, innocent mistake was made. The whole thing's tainted, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, actually. Yeah, I mean, even if the record stands and, yeah, and it's theirs for a few years, people will always say, is it though? Did you know?
Yeah.
Was it somehow? Whatever. The thing, really, they should have sought independent verification long before even making the claim. So that they've always got something rigorous to point to. If there's any doubt, is that, you know, they'd be able to say, well, actually Guinness or whoever have verified this.
They should have a picture of them standing there with a bloke from Guinness. I mean,
why doesn't that happen?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've broken a Guinness record or two in my time, and there's, you know, and what you do is you get the bloke from, or the ladies in the most recent time, to stand there with you doing the grip and grin with the certificate and, you know, and the photograph of that, and that's all the validation you ever need. One photograph. And people can pore over data lines for the rest of eternity. But, you know, ultimately, you've done it. And to not have set that up, you know, and the problem is, as I say, it could be an mistake, but people will say, well, why didn't they do that? It just seems so basic, doesn't it? Such a simple thing to make sure, you know, if you're going to go and break a record, for goodness sake, make sure that you can prove that you have. Because otherwise, people, do you remember, you probably don't, because you weren't even born, the Budweiser rocket. Do you remember that? Do you know what that was?
No, okay, idea.
The Budweiser rocket was a thing driven by a stuntman called Stan Barrett. Very, very brave man. It was basically a Sidewinder missile, literally on wheels, which in 1979 went across Edwards Air Force Base. And they claimed to have broken the sound barrier long before Andy Green and Richard Noble did. You know, like 18 years before. But they only did it in one direction. And the people who were meant to be doing the timing, you know, NASA, who look after that, they, you know, was cast doubts on it and that sort of thing. And, you know, although there are, you know, there are lots of people who will swear blind, you know, that they did break the sound barrier. And there's no question at all. The thing went unbelievably fast. And Stan Barrett is a very, very brave man. Nobody knows. Because the data at the end of the day didn't support the suggested facts. And so, you know, that whole thing has, you know, it was always the sort of, you know, did it, didn't it? And if you're not sure, then effectively it didn't, because you can't say that it did.
Yeah, it's not enough, is it, just to upload a video to YouTube saying, look, we did this. And it's good that there's been scrutiny, because it's really important, because if you're making a claim like this, you need to be held to account. Actually, I see a parallel with Nürburgring lap times, because... I think there is a bit more rigor applied to these now, but in the past, we'd just get a bit of footage from a manufacturer. You'd see the full onboard lap, but you wouldn't know what the car was really. You wouldn't know what tyres it was on, not really. And I think there have been instances where these claims have been made and actually the car's been on different tyres to that which your showroom model will be delivered on.
Yeah, and also, and I'm deliberately not going to name any names now, but if you were a car manufacturer with a very, very good relationship with a tyre manufacturer and you went to that tyre manufacturer and said, could you make me some tyres which look exactly the same as the tyres that we usually use,
but last 13 miles,
but will last 13.1 miles, but you just would, wouldn't you? Now, I have no reason to suspect that has happened. I'm not saying for a moment that it has happened, let alone, you know, any manufacturer might have got involved with that. But it's the sort of thing that could happen and no one would ever know.
Do you know what? People have been trying to go very, very fast in a straight line with cars. People have been trying to go very quickly around laps with cars for more than 100 years. Okay, and it's in that time it's called, being called motorsport. And motorsport comes with very clear, strict regulations there for all to see, and it comes with independent timekeepers, and it always has done. And these top speed attempts and Nürburgring lap times, they are a form of motorsport, and they, the same rigor needs to be applied, because otherwise they're left open to, you know, well, doubt can be cast on any claim, as it has been here. But also, you know, take it to the nth degree, and an unscrupulous company could come along, release some doctored footage, and claim that it's broken a record that it hasn't got anywhere near. You know,
no, it's like, you know, a tennis player being allowed to referee his own match.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's you know, when, you know, Andy Green went across Blackrod Desert at whatever it was, 769 miles an hour in 19, you know, it wasn't Thrust SSC's team who came up with the speeds. It was whoever it was, the United States Auto Racing Club doodah, whatever. You know, it was a completely independent, you know, highly regarded timing body. And so, yeah, I don't know. It is strange, isn't it?
Yeah, and until that rigor is applied, there isn't much credibility in these claims, is there? So, I don't know. This SSC one will rumble on. We're recording this on a Friday, the Friday before it goes out on a Monday. So over the weekend, who knows? Perhaps there'll be further developments. But as it stands, I mean, there is a bit of clarification that SSC need to do, because at the moment, who the hell knows?
Exactly.
Okay, right, well, we're not really supposed to be talking about that stuff in this podcast because, well, frankly, we're trying to tackle British sports cars. We're talking about the low-volume ones. And it's like measuring a coastline, isn't it? The longer you, the sort of more you look, the more intricate and longer it becomes, and there's more and more stuff to talk about. So I think we're barely going to scratch the surface, and we'll have to revisit it again at some point. And we're intentionally not talking about Lotus in this episode because
that's a podcast in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, in its own right, and we'll
probably
come to that
three.
At some point.
Yeah,
yeah. Okay, so how do you want to get us started on low volume British sports car manufacturers?
Well, I mean, the one thing that I have never one thing I do understand is that we have an industry of low volume car manufacturers, unlike that of any other country in the world. You just, I mean, yeah, there are examples, you know, there are companies in Germany, certainly, that make very small numbers of lightweight sports cars, but it's not an entire industry, not like it is over here. And I've never really understood what it is about the British psyche, which has caused this industry to spring up and to flourish. And the closest I've got, I guess, is because we have always, you know, even, you know, larger volume manufacturers have always been making sports cars. You know, you think of the great names that aren't around anymore, you know, names like Austin Healey, and Jensen, and, you know, and plenty of others, you know, Riley and Triumph, and Marcos, exactly, you know, so many names. You know, there is such a history, there's such a heritage in this country of these sorts of cars. I think we do them because we just always have. It's just been, you know, since, I mean, you know, long before the war, you know, you think of those, you know, those pretty little pre-war MGs and that sort of thing, you know, things like PAs and PBs and TCs. That, I think that's where it all sort of sprang from. And we never stopped. I think we've also been helped by, you know, the odd bit of genius design, haven't we? You know, you think of, you know, the original Morgan design, be it with three or four wheels, you know, they're dining out on both to this very day. You think of Colin Chapman coming up with the Lotus 7. And you only need a few cars like that for a few other people to think, wow, I'd like a slice of that pie. I mean, maybe we could do something as good, if not better than that. And then suddenly you've got an industry. And thank heaven for it, because, you know, I just love it. I really do.
I suspect, I mean, the motorsport industry in this country, which is unlike anywhere else, actually, it owes a lot to the aviation industry after the Second World War, when there were all these airfields, so a load of circuits sprung up, but also a load of engineering know-how and manufacturing know-how that just got applied to cars, racing cars and road cars.
And also people weren't rich. They were pretty skint. And so they wanted something that was, you know, affordable but dependable. No, I think you make a very good point.
Okay. So I think the one that I'm most familiar with, of all the companies we're going to talk about, we'll talk about TVR, there's Morgan, there's Ariel, there are so many others. We should start off by talking about Caterham, I reckon. Not least because I drove one again this week and it was brilliant.
we have blabbed on a bit about Caterhams on this podcast, haven't we? Because I went off and drove that Super Sport quite recently. But I think I was talking specifically about that car rather than the company generally. So what is it that does it for you about Caterham? Or maybe it doesn't?
Do you know what? I've sort of blown slightly hot and cold over the years, only because on the road, I often feel vulnerable in them. And so, I, you know, a long motorway journey, if you're overtaking a lorry or something, that's actually quite a hateful exercise for me. I just feel so vulnerable and so exposed that low down in something so tiny that lots of people can't see. And so I have in the past found myself sort of slightly turned off by them. However, when you drive one on circuit or on the right kind of road, or even, frankly, around some cones on a big paddock or tarmac apron or something, they're fantastic. And yeah, so I was driving one again this week for a video, a 310R. So actually one of the less powerful models, but it was fantastic to drive. And I think it's partly because one of the things that really struck me the other day is that they're so linear and so predictable. Okay, so for X amount of throttle, you get X amount of slip at the rear, and that equals X amount of steering correction needed to bring it back. So it's like you're hardwired into it, isn't it? You're just, there's no filter whatsoever. There's literally none. That, you know, there's no power steering. There's no driver aids. No ABS. And so everything that you do with the pedal, any of the pedals, or with the steering wheel or the gear lever, you get a predictable and consistent response from the car. And so you just know that it's just you, this machine, and the road.
And there's something, I find that there is something, what's the right word? I like knowing that if it goes wrong, it can only be my fault, that I've got nothing to blame, because there are no safety systems. I am the safety systems. And therefore, if the safety systems fail, I fail. And I just like that. It's that kind of analog experience, isn't it? It's just you and the machine. And I think what, to me, they do probably better than anything else is they make you a better driver. Can you imagine what driving a Caterham sloppily would feel like? It would just be the most, I mean, goodness knows what it would be like for your passenger, but even for you, it would just be an absolutely hateful experience if every gear change wasn't timed as well as you could do it. Every line through every corner wasn't as neatly executed as you could make it. Every correction to the steering wasn't as, you know, as accurate as you could possibly make it. I mean, that's the whole point of being in the thing. And what that does is it involves you. And we've said on this podcast before that basically that's, you know, driving pleasure, you know, good handling is just an ability to involve the driver. And cars that make you want to drive well, as Caterhams do for me, are inherently great cars because they just involve me in the process. And it's why I, you know, the heavier the car, the more ponderous the car, the more they turn me off, because they're not, you know, they're never going to be particularly accurate as a car. So why should I, as a driver, you know, bother trying to do it myself? It's, yeah.
I also, on a slightly more prosaic level, you know, we celebrate characterful, high revving, normally aspirated engines. We celebrate crisp, communicative steering. We celebrate lightweight engineering. We celebrate good gearboxes. And all of those things just apply to a 7.
Exactly. I mean, how many times, I mean, I'm sure you've done it, I've done it, have you sat down and just sort of sketched out your ideal sports car? And basically, I design a 7 every time. And the funny thing is that, you know, it's more than 60 years. And, you know, for I still don't think, you know, we'll come on to aerials in a minute, and I absolutely bloody love them. But I still think, given a choice for a car like that, I'd have the engine up the other end.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting. Right, now let's talk about racing Caterhams briefly, because we've both done it. I mean, it's such a good school car, isn't it? Like an academy car, literally the Caterham Academy. But also, the quicker ones, they are phenomenally fast machines. But basically a 7, as you said, it makes you a better driver. It also makes you a better racing driver.
Yeah, I haven't raced a really fast one. So, I mean, I've driven plenty on tracks, and I know how unbelievably rapid they are. But to me, it's the same thing. They just make you a better driver. And I think for your point about them being good school cars, you know, I think that you could get up to, you know, a very high level of, you know, automotive or driving education on a Caterham, you know, beyond which you'd have to go to, you know, something with proper downforce before, you know, you needed to find a level that a Caterham couldn't take you to. And you just go up through the ranks, don't you? You start with, you know, a, you know, 150 horsepower, whatever, and end up with, I mean, what's the 620S got at the moment? It's plenty, isn't it?
310. Yeah. It's 310, yeah. Well, I actually did that, climbing the ladder of the Caterham Motorsport ladder. So I did, this was a few years ago, what, 2016, I think, I did 2 rounds. So they've got 5 rungs on the ladder. I couldn't do the Caterham Academy, the bottom one, because I'd already done a bit of racing. And that's for people who have never held a license before. And then I can't remember the name of them all, but, you know, if the Academy is step one, you've then got 2, 3, 4, 5. So I did 2 rounds in 2 rounds in 3 or 4, I can't remember which, and then 1 round in 5. So the whole point was to climb that ladder and try and work out what the differences between them were. And of course, as you climb the ladder, the cars get faster, they get grippier, they become more serious. Until at the top end, you're driving this staggeringly quick thing. And I think they claim that those top spec Caterham race cars are the fastest non-aero racing cars you can get, which I can well believe.
It's interesting. I mean, Tuscans still race.
Okay, so I think we're talking new stuff, modern day stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. But what I found was that, you know, I could qualify in the front row, and I scored a podium in the second rung. But then as you climb through, not only are the cars becoming faster and therefore requiring a sort of a more precise hand, also the competitors are becoming more and more experienced. They've been racing for more, you know, many more years. And so it does become harder and harder. But the, you know, the basic principles of driving these cars quickly remain exactly the same. And what I figured out probably far too late, is at Alton Park, qualifying on a damp circuit. And the funny thing is, you can be hammering around in a 7, certain that you're using every ounce of braking performance, that you're getting all of the cornering grip out of it, that you're using all the power. You can be convinced that you're going as fast as that thing will go and still be 5 or 6 seconds off the pole time. It's the strangest thing. It really is the strangest thing. But then, as you spend a bit more time on the circuit in the car, you begin to work out where you're losing time. And what I found was that a huge amount of time that I was losing was in quick corners. I was just over slowing the car. And I eventually worked out that I had to go in a gear higher, just carry that much more speed and allow the car just to slide out a little bit. Because it's almost paradoxical, but I think in those things, unless you're using all the grip and, you know, unless the car's sliding, you're not using all the grip, which is a weird thing to say because you're clearly over the limit of grip. But if the car's not sliding, there's something in reserve. And it's only by going in a gear higher and allowing the car to wash out on the exit that you're using everything that it has. And that, of course, pays dividends all the way down the following straight. But it's just a good example of learning how to get the most out of a car. And I don't think there's any better car for doing it in, really, than a 7.
No, I agree. No, they're wonderful things. I mean, I've done pretty much everything you could do with a 7. I've owned a couple. I've raced a couple. I've crashed only one, and that was before I was a motoring journalist. I've built one. I'm hoped to be shortly building another, but that's another story.
Interesting.
So yeah, I just I mean, Gordon Murray says cut me and I bleed Lotus. Frankly, if you cut me, I bleed Caterham. I just I just absolutely love them. Yeah, I really do. They are what I want a car to be.
Right, I've got one more thing to say about that Alton Park experience that I had a few years ago. So in one of the races, this doesn't reflect well, does it? On the first lap, I drove into the car in front of me coming out of the hairpin or diving into a braking zone somewhere. And so my race was over after half a lap. And so I had to watch the rest of the race from a marshal's post. And it was at Island Bend, that quick left-hander going down into the hairpin. And I could see lap after lap that the lead two cars that were scampering off away from everyone else, they were sliding, they were drifting, four-wheel drift, quite, you know, plain to see through that corner, and nobody else was. And that was as clear a demonstration as you could hope for of what it took to drive one of those cars quickly. Oh God, it's been far too long since I've nailed one of those things around a circuit. I must put that right.
Next year.
Yeah.
Make your 2021 ambition.
I will. Do you know what? I said that this was a good time to be talking about Caterham because I drove one this week. It's also a good time to be talking about TVR because I drove one this week as well, and it was the first 90s era TVR.
What was it?
A Camaro.
It was a Camaro. What engine did it have in it?
Just the little V8, the 4 litre V8.
4 litre V8. Oh, so a completely sort of cooking Camaro. Actually, a very nice car.
Yeah. Yeah, as simple as they came. Yeah. And it was lovely. I didn't really know what to expect. It was soaking wet, which made me a bit nervous, inevitably. But what I found was that cornering grip was good and consistent. Traction was actually really strong. Of course, they've got no systems on them whatsoever, but they do have... They've got that Blackpool traction control, haven't they? The very long throttle pedal.
Yeah.
That just allows you to...
But they always set them off very, very soft at the back as well. I think they did it like that because they just wanted people to get really good 0-60 times. But, you know, it works. It works. They always have been surprisingly good in that department.
I really liked driving it, actually. It was... I think the only disappointment for me is that the car I drove had the optional power steering, and it seemed a shame to me because otherwise it would have been just like a classic car driving experience, but with, you know, slightly more modern reliability.
I wouldn't be so sad to have the power steering. I mean, they were heavy old brutes without it.
Really? It were better with, you think?
Probably, yeah, because from what I can remember, it actually wasn't a bad system. There was perfectly decent steering feel and... I think you got a quicker rack with it as well. You certainly should have done.
Yeah, that's true. You do.
I mean, when I last drove one of those, it was only a couple of years ago, I was struck. I mean, I don't think there's another car that I've driven recently, which I tested when it was new 20-something years ago, which felt to me like it had aged more. I mean, to me, it felt more like a sort of 1960s... It felt closer to a 1960s Austin Healey than it did to a modern car. And I mean, I'm not saying that's even a bad thing. In many ways, I think these days it's probably quite a good thing.
Exactly. It depends what you're looking for, doesn't it?
Yeah, it depends what you're good for. But I was surprised by how quickly, and basically almost all regards it at age, it felt like a properly vintage car. But not unpleasant. And my point about those TVRs, which I've made a few times before, is, you know, they did have this reputation. We have to be very careful here, actually, because the bloke who used to be TVR's PR bloke is undoubtedly listening to this because he's a mate of ours. And he's
Hello,
the
Ben.
Poor chap who had to ring you up every time you made any kind of comment about TVRs perhaps being not the most reliable of things and try to convince you that they were absolutely as reliable as a 911. The point I was going to make is that, you know, let us say, in a totally hypothetically, they weren't put together in Blackpool quite as well as the finest 993 of its era. Everything that was going to fall off that car would have long since fallen off it and probably been put back by someone who had a slightly better idea of how to do it. Which means, and the thing is those cars are inherently very strong because they've got backbone chassis, they've got big rover engines, they've got Borg Warner gearboxes. I mean, it's all basically ironmongery under there. There's nothing difficult about it. And so, you know, they're actually, if you get a good one, I think they're quite, and you don't mind the fact that it's never going to handle like a Caterham or anything like that, but if you just want a nice old smoker, which looks really cool, will make a lovely noise and waft around the countryside, making you feel good about life, then, you know, I think there's an awful lot to be said for them.
I was surprised at how sort of languid the Camaro felt. I mean, it's not something that you grab and really nail, is it?
You don't hammer it
along a road. You really do stroke it along.
Yeah.
So I've driven a couple of the straight six cars, the later cars, a T350 and a Sagaris, but both dealer cars, and not when they were new. So you know what it's like. Maybe you do, but if I've borrowed a car from a dealer or an owner, I'm just so cautious with it. But what were they like to really, you know, kick the crap out of?
The moment they started putting their own engines in it, the AJPs, the V8 and the straight six, they became very different cars. That languid nature that you talk about, which to me was actually, you know, so much of the appeal of the TVR, you know, because, you know, let's not forget that they had, you know, Targa roofs and they had spacious cabins. They always had big boots. They were actually very usable cars.
Yeah.
But yeah, then you put these incredibly angry engines into them and it changed their character completely. And of course they went, you know, they were incredibly fast. But I don't know. I'd always enjoyed relaxing in those cars. And to me, that's what they were. They were, you know, modern day Austin Healeys, if you like. But they seem to be trying to be something
else.
Road racers. And, you know, and they obviously got a lot more expensive. I'm trying to remember what was the name of the one that I did drive. There was one name, was it the Tamora? Was that one? I think it was, which I think was quite a cheap car. It was, and that was actually because it wasn't quite as angry as the others. That was actually, I seem to remember quite enjoying that. But no, the faster and angrier they got, actually, the less they appealed to me, because they were less usable and they still weren't, to me at least, as enjoyable as, you know, a top of the line Caterham or anything else. So it was still sad when it went to the wall, but I think I understand why.
Mm. When I was 14 years old, I loved no car more than a TVR. I was fanatical about them. I just absolutely adored them. I loved the way they looked. I loved that they were British. I loved that as far as I could tell, looking at the numbers, they were supercar fast for a fraction of the money. I love that they had those crazy interiors. And even now when I see one, which isn't very often, is it really? I smile. Yeah, they're interesting things. I'd love to spend more time driving them. I think if we're talking about TVR, we should just briefly discuss the stuttering revival. What do you reckon of all? Do you think it's going to happen?
Oh, I do so hope so. I mean, the answer to your question is I genuinely don't know. So please, nobody presume I've got some inside knowledge on this, because I haven't spoken to anybody who's had anything to do with it. Well, the last person I spoke to about it was Gordon Murray when he signed the project off. You know, the car is engineered, it's done. I'm only aware of one having been built. I think they announced it. Was it at the Revival in 2017? And the car was there. You know, there was a big thing recently. Steve Cropley went and I think he went and spoke to Les Edgar, who's the head of TVR, and it's all, you know, back on track and good to go, and they're building the factory and this, that and the other. But, you know, the problem is, and I'd say this about any company or indeed any person, you know, we all judge ourselves by what we feel capable of, but everybody else judges us on what we've achieved. And what they've achieved so far is one car in 3 years. And the longer it goes on, you know, I believe they still have some very loyal depositors, which is great. But, you know, and goodness knows, no one would wish COVID on anyone, let alone a startup British sports car company trying, you know, in the most desperate of circumstances to bring a car to market. So, I mean, I can't even begin to imagine how difficult it must be for them. But, you know... The problem I think they have is, I'm afraid the car is old news, but just because it's been around in the public conscious for so long. But also, you know, they still have to get over the hurdle that so many other small sports car companies have failed to negotiate, which is, it's all very well to have a car which looks great. You may or may not think that about the TVR, but I'm not making these comments specifically to that car, and which goes well on paper. It's all very well to build a prototype which does all the things that you promised it would do. It is a completely and utterly different challenge to get that car to market with a quality that the customer will wear at a price the customer can afford or will be prepared to pay. And I've seen so many of these projects come and go, and they always look so good. And then, you know, they come along and we all get terribly excited and they never quite make it because, you know, the quality is not right or the price is too high or some combination of the two. And I understand why that is. It is an unbelievable, I wouldn't try and do it. I mean, it's an unfeasibly difficult thing to do. But, you know, TVR, of all manufacturers, because, you know, rightly or wrongly, you know, there are some people who say that, you know, TVRs have been unfairly represented in terms of their reliability record. But nevertheless, the reputation is out there. I don't think anybody would deny that. So this car has to be right from the get-go. You know, if it comes out and there are question marks over it, then, you know, it's not going to work. I wish it all the very best because I love the name. I love the fact that Gordon Murray has had so much to do with it. And who wouldn't want a company like that to succeed? I really, really hope it does. But I'm far from convinced.
You said a little while ago that it's great in the UK. We've got loads of low volume sports car manufacturers, and we discussed where they, what their origins were. But sadly, the reality is the list of those that are now defunct far exceeds the list of those who are still around churning out cars. And I guess fundamentally, it's just a unbelievably difficult business model, isn't it? Building these things, finding a margin, doing it sustainably.
But it can be done.
Yeah, it can be done. And I think the best example of it in recent times, it's got to be Ariel, hasn't it?
100%. 100%. Yeah, what Ariel have done is, in this regard only, is they have taken a leaf out of Caterham's book, which is, you know, Caterham has survived for as long as they have for two reasons. They have a brilliant design, you know, a work of genius, and they don't make anything themselves. Everything is outsourced. So what Caterham do and what Ariel do is they assemble. So, you know, they don't presume that they're better at doing a certain thing than anybody else. They accept that they're not. So they get the best of the business to produce all their components, and they all come into the factory and they get turned into cars. And that, so far as I know, is the only way those sorts of operations can thrive. If you think you're going to come in there and get to do it all yourself, I think it's just la la land.
It does seem that way.
Yeah. But Ariel, you know, what they have done is so impressive because, you know, not only is the car, you know, amazing to drive, the quality of it, I mean, I don't know, and Ariel's been around for a long time, and we all, and we motoring journalists, we all talk, and particularly if something's, you know, blown up or dropped something or whatever, you know, it goes on. I don't know anybody who's ever been let down by an Ariel. I don't know if you do. And yet we thrash the asses off them. I mean, I was in one this week at Castle Coombe. And I've taken Nomads up to the Sweet Lamb Rally stage and just done terrible things to them. And at the end of the day, you know, they may be absolutely filthy. You may be completely and utterly knackered and fit for nothing but bed and a bath. But, you know, the Ariel's just sitting there, you know, idling away as if it literally has just been got out of the garage. And I think, you know, that really, really appeals to people. Also, you know, the other thing they do, which is so clever, is they control their volumes. They've never tried to build 500 cars in a year. Because, you know, if you configure your factory to do that and things get a bit tough, then, you know, you could be in a lot of trouble very quickly. If, however, you configure your assembly facility to make a very, very low volume of cars, you know, two things happen. One is that, you know, you will always be tapped into the hardcore of people who will always want that kind of car almost regardless. And secondly, your residuals will stay sky high. And so people will want them because, you know, and it is the absolute truth that if you buy yourself a new Atom today and you get Ariel to service it and you don't smash it to bits and don't do stupid miles in it. I mean, it's not quite a free car, but the residuals, you know, the depreciation on a car like that is so small. And that is such a rarity these days in modern cars that, you know, the financial downside to having such an amazing thing in your shed is absolutely tiny. And you'll always be able to get out of it because there will be always be somebody who wants it.
Same with Caterham Sevens. Those things,
yeah.
The money that you sell them for after a year or two, it's more or less what you paid for it. It's staggering, really.
Yeah.
It is as close as you're going to get to a free sports car, isn't it?
Yeah. And they don't get greedy. I mean, I think that, you know, particularly TVR, but I also think the old Noble company, you know, I think the problems that they ran into was, well, I mean, either volume related or often they just tried to, you know, make a bit more money by putting their prices up. And maybe they needed to do that to cover their overheads. I don't know. But, you know, both Caterham and Ariel, they know what kind of cars they should be making. They know what sort of cars their customers expect. They know what their customers are prepared to pay. And so they make that. They don't try and push to make a bit more short-term money and risk, you know, a long-term loss.
Okay, I reckon we can cover off one more of these low-volume British sports car manufacturers.
Cool.
And we need to talk about Morgan.
Yeah.
So I a friend of mine brought one over the other day. He's running one as a long-termer for a few months, and he brought it over the other day, and it's one of the new ones. So new platform, isn't it? And new BMW engines and so on. And it was hilarious. I was, you know, I presumed that after all this time with a new car, they'd have all those little foibles figured out. But he said, if it's raining, even with the roof up, you get wet.
Is that charming or is that annoying?
I suspect it's quite annoying, isn't it? I mean, would you be prepared to overlook that stuff? I don't think I would.
It's not necessary. You know, if you're in a Caterham and it rains, you put the roof up, you don't get wet.
Yeah.
You know, I once drove a Caterham from Dartford to the south of France overnight, basically in a rainstorm the entire way. And it wasn't a particularly pleasant journey, but I didn't have a drop of water on me. So there's no excuse for cars that leak in 2020. But the question is Morgan an exception? Because they've never tried to be a modern car. And even when they have modern underpinnings, that's not what people buy into, is it? I mean, what they want, I think, is actually an old car. And they will put up with old car foibles, but not old car failings. So as long as it's mildly annoying, that's absolutely fine. But what they don't want is for it to let them down. And I think that would be terrible. I mean, was it a plus four or a plus six that you drove?
I didn't drive, actually. It was a plus four.
Okay. So I've driven them both. And I mean, they're expensive. You know, you could write a list as long as your arm of things that weren't right with them. But I found myself feeling quite well disposed towards them because I'm an old fogey and these cars, I'm afraid, tend to be bought by old fogies. I kind of understand. It's not these are not cars for me, okay? I do not wake up in the morning thinking, God, I wish I had a Morgan in the shed, in the way that I think, God, I wish I had a Caterham in the shed. I've never had that thought. But I do understand, to an extent, the appeal of the looks and that slightly, well, that very retro feel they have. And the thing I will say about the modern breed, the breed that's just come out, is they don't, as a driver, they don't wind you up, or in fact drive you completely up the wall in the same way that the old ones used to, because they were just incompetent. Because, you know, until quite recently, you know, all the old 4.4s and plus 4s, I think they made the last one this year actually, they had front suspension technology that dated back to the First World War, and I am not kidding. you know, sliding pillar front suspension. And you know, is that quaint? Is that charming? Or is it just hopeless? Well, I mean, I went and drove one actually briefly, having driven the new one, and it is just hopeless. And so I just don't think people who buy Morgans are particularly demanding of those cars.
Well, and also, they wouldn't have anything else, would they? That's what they want.
No, I mean, I know a bloke, he's a mate of mine. He's really pretty well resourced, and he normally knocks about the place in the latest 911 Turbo. And he was bought by his missus for his birthday, a sort of factory tour of Morgan. And he went along with a friend of his, and they had the factory tour, and the big sort of yee-haw at the end of it was they got to have a, I don't know, 20-mile test drive in one of the new Morgans. And he rang me up afterwards, and he went, "That is without doubt the worst car I have ever driven in my entire life, and I think I'm going to buy one."
There you, it's just impossible to pin down, isn't it? But it's there. There's an appeal despite everything.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I mean, you know, I think they're doing very well. I mean, when I spoke to them, you know, despite, and this, that was this year, and this was, I think it must have been just after lockdown ended. You know, their order books were pretty full. I mean, not the sort of 3+ years that they used to be, but that's a good thing because, you know, you don't want people waiting 3 years for the products because they just get pissed off and go and buy something else. And they seem pretty chipper. So, you know, all power to them. I wish them all the best. They're just not really my kind of car, but that's probably says as much about me as it does about Morgan's.
Right. Before we end the podcast, is there anything else you want to mention? Do you want to talk about Invicta? Do you want to talk about Van Wall?
I mean, Invicta, some will remember that Invicta, which was a grand old name from the sort of 1930s, really, came back in, early part of this century. And, you know, I drove it, but it was an example of how not to do it, in my view, because I think, for me, the mistake they made was they did try to do it all themselves. I remember being shown around the unit where these things were, I don't know how many they built in the end, but I think probably single digits. And, you know, they were showing me the autoclave where they cured their own carbon fibre and did this, that and the other. They basically did the whole thing themselves. And so I suppose that's an example of how...
They didn't do everything themselves.
No, not everything, but
the rear lights were off a Passat.
Very good. Very good. I did not know that. Thank you. What else should we talk? I mean, Jensen, that was another one that had a... Jensen tried to come back in the 1990s, and I think they actually made a few cars. I think they made about 30 or 40 cars before they succumbed to the inevitable. And Van Wall, all I'll say about Van Wall is there was the news last week, wasn't there, that they're going to make 5 recreations of the cars that won the first ever Formula One Constructor Champion in 1958, with the cars which were driven mainly by Stirling Moss and Tony Brooks. And when I heard that Van Wall were going to come back, I did worry that it was going to be some inappropriate use of, you know, a grand old name from British racing. But in fact, you know, the company that's going to make these cars, Hall and Hall, they're as good as they get. The cars will be indistinguishable from the originals. You know, there really aren't any Van Wals out there racing at the moment. And, you know, as you and I know perfectly well, when we go to places where there are historic races, there are so many recreated cars there. And if they look the same and they sound the same and they drive the same, then, you know, as long as nobody ever tries to pass them off as something that they're not, then, you know, I don't have a problem with it.
Yep, fair enough. Okay, well, there we go. I think we should wrap that one up there. And we must come on to Lotus soon, mustn't we? I mean, there's not only the history, but everything that's going on nowadays. It's going to be such a rich topic.
I think we are not far, and I'm not sure I have a reason for saying this. I just sort of feel it in my water that we're not far from a big announcement about the next car. So maybe we should just wait until we get something from them, which we can then use as a hook to tee up the next podcast. Because absolutely, I mean, Lotus is... it's such an amazing subject, isn't it? I mean, you know, if you wrote the story of Lotus as a sort of, I don't know, a drama, people would just, you know, the script editor would just chuck it back at you as being too implausible. you know, up, down, in, owner after owner after owner, and yet still somehow it's still there. I look forward to that one very much indeed.
Yeah, good, good. We will come on to it. So everybody, please do remember to rate the podcast and leave us a review. It really does help. And go and check out our Patreon, patreon.com/DriveNation. There's a link in the description of this podcast, actually. And you can follow that and give us a few quid each month. That'd be good, wouldn't it?
That would be absolutely excellent, yeah. and in return, we promise that we will continue to come back every week and talk rubbish out of your radio or your earphones or wherever you're listening to this for the foreseeable.
Yeah, and we will be back next week.
Yep, look forward to it.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.